effect, only a lot cheaper and without the bloodshed and destruction. In my mind, you know, the Russians will continue waging the war if they must, but if they don't have to, they will stop where they are. And then a lot of these things are going to get solved through negotiations and through, let's call it, incremental measures that are going to be implemented over years and decades, because the Russians are looking for a permanent solution, not to, you know, color the whole map red and say, voila, we've made all these great contacts, because then you have to administrate these areas. You still have to administer them. It's easier if you, you know, gain influence over Kiev and then have the Ukrainian authorities administer the country in a way that moves it towards your objectives, which again is a friendly partner nation and a buffer between Russia and the West, a neutral nation. I think the 28-point peace plan is a solid foundation for all of that. And then many of the details that are in there are maybe not, they're not cemented. They could get bent in negotiations. Some of them give Russia the way to show goodwill by compromising, by saying like, all right, fine, you know, we don't have to, we can share Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. We're going to run it jointly. That's fine. And so I read it in a very positive way. I'm not sure why so many analysts read it as some kind of sinister trap for the Russians. If you contrast it to the European plan, which the Europeans drafted practically as a panic knee-jerk reaction, you see that it's very, very different. And then you also see that the Europeans are extremely vexed about the American peace plan, and they're trying to shut it down by whatever means that they can.
Actually, they're trying to come up with an alternative to what the Americans put out. And how do you find the meeting in Geneva? You know, Marco Rubio went there talking. It seems that as CNN reported that three crucial points in this document were removed. One of them is territorial concession, the limitation on the military size of Ukraine, and the NATO memberships, the NATO membership for Ukraine. How, if we assume that Europeans somehow managed to remove them from the document, is that possible? Do you think that is still workable?
I think that anything is possible, but I think it's very highly unlikely, because the opposition to this peace plan is pushed by very, very weak players. So we're talking about the Europeans. Europeans have no cards to play. They don't have a military. They don't have any leverage. Not only that, but the principal pushers of this opposition to the American plan are the governments in London, Paris, and Berlin. All three of them are deeply, deeply unpopular in their own nations. And then, you know, I think that part of the game is also with these anti-corruption investigations that are going on in Ukraine. They are clearly and definitely run by the American side. They control these anti-corruption agencies, and the $100 million embezzlement was just the tip of the iceberg. But it has already shattered the ruling clique around Zelensky. So three or four of his closest collaborators ran away and went to Israel. Yermak, We don't know if he's long for government work. And so he's under tremendous pressure. But as we now know, the real corruption probe will end up smearing a lot of these European warmongers, like you know, like the Estonians and the French and the Brits and the Germans, because we're talking about anything between $50 and $100 billion with a B. And I think that part of the game is to exert pressure on them, because if they don't, really, really ugly stuff might be coming up in the very near future. And I think this is part of the reason why Donald Trump recently went to London and met with Keir Starmer. You know, what we learn about these meetings is, it's almost like he went there for a cup of tea and crumpets, but I think that behind closed doors, maybe the discussion is different. Maybe the discussion is, look, we have all this information, we have traces of this much money moving to London banks. Please cooperate, we can do this the easy way, or we can do it the ugly way. And so I think that probably similar warning went to other places in Europe, Paris, Estonia particularly. Apparently Estonian banks have been one of the key conduits of this. And this is ultimately, you know, ultimately most of this money is the money of US taxpayers. So if this comes out, it's really going to be embarrassing for the Europeans, and it's going to cause anger among the American people against the European elites. And then even before anything is known much about all this, it's already strengthening the hand of people like Robert Fico and Viktor Orban, who want to preserve peace in Europe and who want to reform the European Union. And it's weakening the hand of, you know, Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas, who I don't even know who they work for, but they definitely don't work for any constituents as we would recognize them in a democracy. And so all of this is now bearing down on not only Ukraine, but also the EU. So the territorial concessions might, you know, this might go back and forth more than once. And in the end, I think the longer the Ukrainians and the Europeans oppose the American peace plan, the worse their position is, because the Russians are meanwhile gaining on the ground, and there's a good chance that in the next 2-3 months, the Russian forces might be on the Dnieper River. And, you know, interestingly enough, one of the provisions in the peace plan is that the Russians will not interfere with Ukrainian trade along the Dnieper River. maybe they're already seeing the problem in advance. Well, you know, we'll see. They're already near the Dnieper in the south. But, you know, I wonder, you know, we also had tweets, unofficial statements from people like Kirill Dmitriev, who said that this peace agreement is based on the understanding reached between the two sides in Alaska in August, which we don't know exactly what it was, because we only got very broad brush reports from those meetings. But I imagine that if they met there in person, that some very detailed notes were being exchanged between the two sides. And then, you know, in the aftermath of that meeting, Kirill Dmitriev himself tweeted that Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump will prevent World War II from breaking out. Will prevent. He didn't say could, might, should. He said will, which tells me that they have reached this kind of an understanding, and that they, since August until now, that they built on that to come up with a 28-point plan.
Alex, I think the main point, one of the main points that you've made, is that Russia wants Ukraine to be somehow like Belarus, you know, a prosperous, calm, you know, somehow neutral when it comes. Because the case of Ukraine is somehow different from Belarus, because Russia wants Ukraine to be neutral. they don't want a government in Ukraine to be the enemy of the worst enemy of Russia, bringing NATO in and all of these scenarios that we were talking about. But with when Europeans are pushing for a 600 or in document is 600,000 soldiers, Europeans are talking about 800,000 soldiers. This is not a good sign for any agreement. If you want a neutral state on your border, you don't make a military that none of these European countries have the size of it. You know? Because this. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, that's another one of those points that could be two or three pages, because it doesn't, the agreement doesn't say 600 or 800 soldiers. It says military personnel. So, you know, that might be combat-ready troops, reserves. It could be administrative personnel and so on. So, you know, maybe we're talking about 50,000 combat-ready troops. We might be talking about 200 or 300,000 reserves. We might be talking about 100,000, 200,000 administrative personnel, auxiliary, you know, personnel and so on. So it's not... I mean, when this war started, when Ukraine was at its peak strength, well, according to Ukrainians themselves, they were at close to like 600,000-700,000 troops. Zelensky himself was talking about over a million, but I think he was exaggerating. So, you know, that would restore Ukrainian military back to where it was when the war started in 2022. I don't think that that's the intent of the agreement, and I don't think that the Russians would agree to that. And if they don't agree to that, they don't have to sign the peace agreement. So, you know, forcing this kind of a solution on them seems to me like, if it were a trap, it's like the dumbest trap ever devised, because, you know, they're not going to overlook that detail. I think that this is, the number is substantial, but it's reflecting military personnel, not combat ready troops, not soldiers.
Yeah. Alex, the other point is this, the case of Steve Witkoff. We know that he's going to be in Russia, he's going to go to Russia with the document, the official document. It seems that he's going to communicate with the Russian president and his administration. Looking at the way that they're attacking Steve Witkoff in the United States, somehow in the mainstream media and, you know, in social network, and calling Witkoff as Russian puppet, KGB agent, you know, he's trying to, he has a lot of ties with Russia in terms of, you know, it's all about, it shows that something is happening behind the scene that these people are not happy about. How do you see the division, you know, some sort of fracture or division that is happening, that is that exists within the Trump administration? It seems that Marco Rubio and Keith Kellogg, you know, the plan, the document that was published, and everybody was asking, why do they need to publish this document? It seems that Keith Kellogg was behind it. He published it before resigning from his position. And how do you see Donald Trump managing these sort of differences within the administration?
We have to guess because we don't know, but it seems to me that Trump had to let's say that he didn't want to show his hand too soon. Do you know what I mean? So you kept Keith Kellogg to make it seem like you were entertaining the pro-European, anti-Russian type resolution of this crisis, and to give them hope that they might be able to pull Trump back into their game. Even though I always thought it was a bit fake, because Trump already declined to give Ukraine a security guarantee, which was the super high priority for the Europeans. You know, this is what Keir Starmer has been trying to obtain in his early, you know, trips to Washington, D.C. at the beginning of the Trump administration. This is what Vladimir Zelensky has been trying to obtain when last year in October, I think, or even September, he flew to New York before Trump was even elected. And he was saying, well, here, we'll give you this 500 billion natural resources deal in exchange for a security guarantee. What does that mean? Well, security guarantee basically means that if, let's say, Poland, France, Britain, Germany put in some tripwire troops on the ground in Ukraine, whatever, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, it doesn't matter. They're not going to win the war. But when they come under attack, which they would, then they would say, like, aha, look, the Russians attacked us. Now you have to make good on your security guarantee. So that was basically like a tripwire for World War III. And Trump said, no, I'm not giving you a security guarantee. And then there was, for several months, there was this back and forth. You know, it's kind of dissipated from the news cycle, but there was this back and forth about Ukrainian natural resources, that, you know, the Ukrainian minerals, the whatever, $10-12 trillion worth. And then, you know, like, it turned out that they made a secret deal with the Brits that they take control of the bulk of Ukrainian natural resource wealth. And then, you know, Boris Johnson went to Ukraine to try to persuade Zelensky to play along with Trump, but none of it happened. So I think that this whole game with Steve Witkoff was as genuine as Trump saying, oh, I'm very disappointed in Putin. It's all for show. It's all for certain internal political constituencies, some audience that he needs to kind of misdirect and pacify, so that they don't go into overt, they don't conspire against him to sabotage his peace deal. But I think that from the beginning, the intent was to pacify Europe. And I'll give you a story that is extremely important. Give me a second. Okay. Sorry, my butler is asking for instructions. So a very good example is what happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and I've spoken about this over the last 2-3 weeks in a few podcasts, and I published an article about this because it's extremely important, but it's not in the news cycle at all. Namely, Bosnia-Herzegovina, capital is Sarajevo, right? That's where World War I was detonated. It was being rigged to become the second front in the West's war against Ukraine, against Russia. And so this was being done by staging provocations between Serbs and Croats and Muslims, which are the three constituent peoples of the country, and particularly antagonizing the Serbian entity there, to the point where for this fall they were planning a referendum for secession. So the Republika Srpska was going to secede from Bosnia. And that was practically certain to precipitate a war between Republika Srpska and the rest of the Bosnian Federation with the government in Sarajevo. Well, if this war happened, Serbia would not be able to stay neutral. They would have to come in on the side of Republika Srpska. Croatia would be drawn in because it has a Croatian minority in Bosnia. Croatia is a NATO member nation. Hungary would possibly be drawn into this war. Hungary is also a NATO member nation. So this could practically open a front NATO against Serbia and Republika Srpska. In which case, Russia would not be able to stay neutral. They would have to come in. So this is how they engineered this conflict to draw Russia into a second front war. The playbook is very, very similar to the way World War I was engineered. And World War I ended up with a total devastation of Europe and 40 million casualties. So here's what happened. First, the Russians exerted pressure on the Serbian leadership in Republika Srpska to work within the Dayton Accords, which is how, you know, which was the way that the country was constituted, and the war ended in 1995. And then Donald Trump actually put his political weight behind Milorad Dodik, who was a very popular president of Republika Srpska. And so they preserved the Serbian leadership through like a proxy candidate, right, of Milorad Dodik. So they, you know, formally they complied with the diktat from Sarajevo, from the Federation, which comes through the European Union. I'm sorry, this is complicated, but basically what I want to tell you is that the war in Bosnia has been diffused for the time being for at least a year, because the Serbs agreed to delay their referendum by at least a year. So instead of holding that referendum now, they might hold it in a year's time. But, you know, by then we'll see. Anyway, it was widely perceived in Bosnia that the British were exacerbating this pressure that were leading to the war. And it was very clearly the cooperation between the Russians and the Trump administration that diffused this powder keg. And then three weeks ago, I met one of the members, I think I mentioned this in our last conversation, one of the members of the government of Republika Srpska, who told me so. And he said, since Trump came into office, things are much, much better. And they said it was the differences like day and night. And then another Croatian politician who, he didn't tell me that, I heard it in like a podcast interview. He said that the difference between Bosnia during the Biden administration and now is like day, is like living on a different planet. This is not discussed in the media. Nobody's talking about Bosnia-Herzegovina. There are no wealthy donors from Bosnia and Herzegovina that Trump has to placate. There isn't a large voting bloc of Bosnian Serbs or Serbs at all in the United States. So this is an example where it seems that out of the cooperation between Russia and the United States, World War III in Europe really was diffused for the time being. And so if that is so, and this is a real story, you know, this is not a conspiracy, this is a real story that the media is ignoring. If that is the case, then could it be the case that a similar effort is being earnestly pursued in Ukraine? Not only that, could it be that a similar effort is being earnestly pursued in the Middle East? Because remember, not long ago, Al-Jolani went to Moscow and met with Vladimir Putin. And everybody was, well, what was this all about? Well, there's Russians betraying the Syrian people. And then after that, Al-Jolani went to Trump, and everybody had their heads explode. Look, Donald Trump is shaking hands with an Al-Qaeda head chopper. But, you know, nobody seems to consider that, you know, what my friend Tom Wongo mentioned is that I think that Trump and Putin were telling Jolani, now you work for us, and we're playing a different game than your British and Turkish overlords. And I think that in a way, Turkey is also being brought on board to cooperate in this. So I think that there's, you know, people say that I give Trump too much credit, but I think that it's plausible, and I would say that it's even probable, that a new security architecture is being developed and prepared for the world as we speak, that peace in Ukraine will be a major piece, part of that equation, and that the ongoing investigations against the Ukrainian government and oligarchs and the European leadership is part of that. They're going to force them to come on board, or they're going to be history. it's going to lead to a wave of regime changes in Europe. And so, you know, the peace is being pushed by very strong players, being Russia and the United States, and it's being opposed by very, very weak players with no cards to play.
Alex, I really believe the hardcore of what's going on in Ukraine is the corruption. Because if they do something about it, and if the people being informed about what is happening in Ukraine in terms of who's receiving the money, who's benefiting from the war in Ukraine, that would be hugely game changer in Europe. And
yes.
You know, the new article in the Telegraph, they're attacking, you know, the opposition in Germany. Because about the ties that the German opposition with Russia, you know, AfD, they're talking about they're connected with Russia, they have a lot of ties with Russia. Because they feel the only way that, you know, we're going to be informed about the corruption, the roots of the corruption and where it goes and how deep it goes, it would come from one of these three key countries in Europe, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. We know that the United Kingdom is not going to be, no change in the United Kingdom, in the policy of the United Kingdom would happen in the near future, in the long run. The only option would be the Germany and AfD coming to power in Germany and just showing to the people what has happened. You know, showing the documents, you know, the roots and how corruption is deep in with the case of Ukraine. How do you see, because if we assume that the new government in Ukraine would do something about it, it's somehow delusional, because the new government would have a lot of problems in Ukraine if, in the case of, if we assume that some sort of settlement would happen in Ukraine. How do you see the move toward the attacks on AfD? It seems that the attack are aimed at, you know, at what I've just mentioned to you.
I think that we will probably find that soon, but I think it's impossible to predict. It's very obvious that the Europeans are now in a kind of a panic, and they are doubling down on censorship. I think because exactly they don't want people to find out what we're about to find out. I have to mention this because I have a suspicion that they are considering introducing lockdowns again to give them a way to force people indoors, to force them like curfews, make sure that people can't come out and protest, and they can introduce very draconian censorship regime. And I, you know, a good friend of mine who has a very, very popular channel on Facebook, well, I don't know if you call that channel, but he had 70,000 followers. And he was one of the people who was very early mounting meaningful opposition to lockdowns in 2020 and 2021. And so he gained a lot of followers. And he has continued talking about the problems with the lockdowns and the pandemic and, you know, what he has done to children in schools and all of this. And so suddenly, after 5 years, they completely erased his Facebook account. In Croatia, a lot of people go to Facebook because Twitter is not that popular and people are not yet...
Here in Brazil, it's the same way. Facebook.
Yeah, so Facebook is kind of disproportionately important. So all of a sudden, no warnings, no, you know, take down this post or anything. They just like squashed him completely. Well, he kept coming. So he had a backup account that had almost no visible connection to him. It was just called Free People. I think within a day or two, they deleted that account as well. And then, you know, we had about last week, we had some British Baroness Heather, or I forget her name, publish a 1,500-page inquiry on on the lockdowns until 2020 and 2021. And it wasn't an inquiry about what devastation it caused, how it damaged children who couldn't go to school, what economic damage it wreaked because it destroyed so many small and medium-sized businesses and people losing income and debt exploding, or who should spend the rest of their lives in prison. It was more like how we might have done this better. And the conclusion of her inquiry is that the government was too hesitant. They didn't lock us down hard enough. So she said that the lockdowns might have been of shorter duration had they gone harder and less hesitantly into applying all these measures, which included contact tracing, masks, social distancing, and so forth. All the things that have proven to have no firm foundation in science. So like, to avoid longer lockdowns, it would be necessary to go harder path with all these nonsensical measures. So I thought that's really bizarre that she just ended up publishing this inquiry at this time. And then 2 days before the inquiry was published, we had a very stark warning from the European Central Bank, saying that, oh, things are really rough, there's going to be crises, and the banks in Europe have to be prepared, which is another unusual thing, because banks normally go out of their way to assure everybody that everything is fine. You know, don't run into the bank and get all your money out because everything is great. You know, there's no danger. You relax and disperse, nothing to see here. Instead, they're giving this stark warning. And that, you know, so they're shutting up people who are anti-lockdown. They are publishing inquiries saying like, okay, lockdowns have to be much, much harder next time. And then, you know, they're warning us that there's something going wrong with the banking system, which is exactly what started the previous lockdown. Well, you know, in 2019, we had this thing called the repocalypse, you know, when the repo markets exploded. And now we know that last summer, so not summer 25, but summer 24, that the Bank of England had to step into the British repo markets. Repo means a repurchase agreement. These are short-term borrowing arrangements between banks, where they, you know, banks routinely lend money to each other overnight just so that they could close their books and balance everything. So if one bank is short on liquidity, it might borrow bank against collateral just overnight or a very short term.